Good morning. It's Saturday, November 29th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Sidney Lee. Sidney Lee has been described as a man in the woods with his head full of books, and a man in books with his head full of woods. His most recent collection of poems is Ghost Pain. His second nonfiction volume, A Little Wildness, Some Notes on Rambling, was published in 2006. He founded New England Review in 1977 and edited it till 1989. Of his seven previous poetry collections, Pursuit of a Wound was one of three finalists for the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. The preceding volume, To the Bone, New and Selected Poems, was co-winner of the 1998 Poets Prize. In 1989, Lee also published the novel A Place in Mind with Scribner, and the book is still available in paper from Storyline Press. His 1994 collection of naturalist essays, Hunting the Whole Way Home, was reissued in paper by the Lions Press in 2003. Lee has received fellowships from the Rockefeller, Fulbright, and Guggenheim Foundations and has taught at Dartmouth, Yale, Wesleyan, Vermont, and Middlebury Colleges, as well as at Franklin College in Switzerland and the National Hungarian University in Budapest. His stories, poems, and essays and criticism have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The New York Times, Sports Illustrated, and many other periodicals, as well as in more than 40 anthologies. He lives in Newbury, Vermont, where he is active in statewide literacy and conservation efforts. Sidney was kind enough to meet me in Montpelier on Election Day. I began by asking him how he approaches the blank page when he's beginning a work of poetry or prose.
I tend, in whatever genre I'm undertaking, to begin in the same way. I've written one novel, and I have another one that's in draft, and I don't know if I'll ever do to it what needs doing. Time is, my biological clock is ticking. We'll be 66 next month. Whatever I write tends to originate in the same way. There are at least two, sometimes three, things that, speaking kind of vaguely, have stopped me in my tracks somehow or another. It might be a snatch of conversation I've overheard. Mm-hmm. Being deaf, sometimes I've misunderstood it, which can be an advantage. Something that I've seen in my rambles. I'm one that spends a lot of time in the woods and on the water, or some memory. If there are two, ideally three of those things, I start writing the thing that will connect them. And my assumption is that they are connected merely by virtue of the fact that I'm the one to have experienced them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I always write in the first person or whatever. But I think what often, certainly in my students, younger students especially, after they've been at it somewhat seriously for a spell, they get over it, but the most common cause of writer's block is, I didn't have any ideas, you know. And I always say, well, that's a good thing, you know, because if you have ideas that precede the execution, then there won't be any discovery in the process of the writing. You'll simply be writing illustrations rather than discovering anything on your own. I have this almost mystical belief in the power of language to tell me what it is that needs to be said. There's one famous spiritual tradition, one of whose spokesmen says, in the beginning was the Word, and I take that almost literally, that if I can abandon myself to the language in a sense will tell me what needs to be written about. I'm fond of citing, when I was in college, and most of my good friends, and this is abided, I don't really know why, it doesn't matter, were and are architects. And so I heard a certain amount of architectural buzz. And one thing in the 60s that I heard, and it came back to me later on when I was a teacher, was the famous architect Louis Kahn, when he was teaching at Penn, would always tell his students that they needed to ask what the building itself wanted to be. And if I can be open to what the poem or the essay or the story wants to be, and can get out of the way and listen to the language that's coming to me, it's certainly, it's not, the result is not necessarily good every time, but it's better than it would have been if I thought I would sit down like John Milton and justify the ways of God to man, or write a poem about free will, or write a poem about politics even, you know, because I already know what I'm going to say before I say it in those instances. And so I think the result is kind of, is inevitably wooden. There's not anything I can do about it. Mm-hmm. I'm writing to something predetermined, and that's, first of all, not much fun, and second of all, I don't think terribly productive.
Now you mean as far as theme as opposed to inspiration?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm uncomfortable with the word inspiration, and I'm really not sure why. I guess just because there's that of the Puritan in me who feels that, you know, if it's all inspired, then you're not doing enough work. The inspiration for me tends to come in revision. Mm-hmm. When I see what I've put down in something of a rush and begin to notice certain patterns. They may not be coherent, certain word choices, even because I'm half a lousy formalist in my writing of poetry, even implicit rhymes or other kinds of or metrical patterns. When I revise, revision is seeing again. When I begin to see what was on my mind that I didn't know was on my mind, then I feel something akin to inspiration. But to begin with, to go back to your question, to begin with some thematic precept would be ruinous. Mm-hmm. For me. We all tried that when we started to write Shelley, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, now I'm going to write a poem of them having to do with what I feel about the state of the nation or something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
One of the great difficulties of any kind of political poetry, and I don't have any brief against political poetry of whatever stripe, and people like Pablo Neruda have written it splendidly, but, you know, the difficulty with it, again, is this absence of discovery. You know, I sort of know what my politics are. I'm being interviewed on election day, so that's sort of on my mind. But I'm not interested in writing about what I already know I know. I'm interested in discovering what I didn't know I knew.
A lot of your work deals with the natural world and, mm-hmm. and your experiences of trekking through Vermont woodlands. Mm-hmm. In reading many of your poems, I think of the expression that I saw on a T-shirt recently that said, "All who wander are not lost." Is that it?
Well, I suppose it does fit. I spend a lot of time in the woods, but I don't like to follow trails, especially trails made by other people. I like to improvise as I go, and I think that all who wander are not lost is maybe a good description of any kind of a poet, whether he or she is wandering in the city or wandering in his or her mind or wandering in other writers' universes or whatever. It's this this faith that one has that if he or she gets off the beaten path, something might turn up. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's really, it doesn't sound very exalted, but when I sit down to write a poem, I'm just hoping something may turn up that I hadn't expected. And for me, merely by virtue of my own enthusiasms and where I live, you know, the natural world is there for me. It's been a passionate interest of mine since I was a little kid. I inherited it from my father and other relatives. So That's the most obvious, sort of a smorgasbord in front of me.
This might be a good time for you to read something.
I'll read one that is not published. It will be shortly. I found myself recently, for whatever reason, remembering a time in my life when live jazz music was extremely important to me, a little harder to come by where I've lived for the last 40 years. But when I was in college, and even younger when I was in high school, I'm talking about the music primarily of the sort of Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis era, late bebop in a sense. And I taught high school in Philadelphia in a private school for a year after I graduated from college. And that would have been the year 1965, the year of the Selma March, as a major kind of event in American history. And one of the bands that I loved was Cannonball Adderley, the alto saxophonist band. And he came to a club called Pep's Musical Bar, which was owned by Will Chamberlain, the basketball player.
Oh, yeah.
And the tune, I remember, a wonderful tune written by his piano player, Joe Zawinul, called Mercy, 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 and that's the title of the poem.
Okay.
Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. The Stilt, they called him, or the Big Dipper. Chamberlain was the man for whom they changed the rules, because one night he scored 100 points in the game. And Wilt owned Pep's Musical Bar, Broad and South, Philadelphia, 1965, where the kick-ass Adderley sextet of the time, with Cannonball on alto, his brother Nat on cornet, Joe Zawinul on keyboard, Yusef Latif on tenor, Sam Jones bass, and Lewis Hayes drums, where that kick-ass band was turning out the whole damn place. It was standing room only. And there I was standing in a jam-packed aisle between bar and booth, in love with sound. How precise it is the way I remember that Yusef had launched into Gemini when I felt the tap on my shoulder and turned and looked straight into the middle button of a splash weave jacket and heard the voice from way on high. Pardon me, white man. What else on earth would I do but pardon? I felt, in fact, it was I who needed pardon, and not because I felt fear, as I might have, the man being more than tall, the man being wide as a truck as well, which you couldn't tell on television. No, not fear, but rather the total incapacity, my own or anyone else's, to take that night and the muted light and the mellow feeling from liquor and blow every ounce of it all out into air in one huge breath, a cloud that would somehow change the world that I knew surrounded everybody. Dr. King was trying to change it then. You watch that every day on TV. The frothing dogs and redneck cops, the clubs, the hoses, the cattle prods. I was just 21 in 65, so this was likely my own first inkling that goodwill and hope can count for nothing, and magical thinking may buy you at best a beer if you can make your way, pardon me, pardon me, pardon me, pardon me, past that wall of black bodies and up to the bar, and make yourself heard over harmonies and tumbles down into dissonance, and back again of the reeds and cornet, above the percussion, above the funky, wrenching chords that Joe broke into next on Mercy, Mercy, Mercy.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
So 65, what point was Wilt Chamberlain in his career at that point?
Oh, he was he was really sort of at the height of his career.
Yeah.
He played with the Philadelphia team, I think, until 1967 when they won an NBA championship.
Right, right.
And then went on to the Lakers thereafter. But he was a young man at that time. I remember coming out of that club later, and he had a Bentley automobile. With the front seat removed, he drove from the back seat. He was that big. He was immense, incredibly strong, imposing figure.
Drove from the back seat of the car.
Yeah, yeah. But he looked so big and gangly on TV, but to see him up close, this was a big, huge man. I mean, he looked skinny because he was so athletic in life and so on. But up, his shoulders were twice as broad as my own, and I was not a small guy.
But. Yeah. I noticed on your website a recent piece called Ownership, dedicated to your friend John Engels, about his death. This is a quote from Ownership. A very, very sick man recently told me when I asked him what he'd learned from his bout with cancer and chemotherapy, that the best things in the world happen every day. That lesson seems like one that exists in your poetry, in lots of small ways.
Yeah, well, I hope so. It's if I can remember that, then I stay as sane as I am apt to be. It's very easy to think, well, I've got to jump through that next hoop down the road a little ways in order to get to the next hoop, as if life were all preparation for something and a kind of a dress rehearsal. And the sick man I'm referring to is my wife's brother, who's had an ongoing, and one hopes, as of late, successful bout with colon cancer, with which he was diagnosed at the tender age of 41. And he was the one that mentioned that to me, and there's so much wisdom in it, really. It's an odd thing. A lot of us have to be reduced to a condition that could be described as extreme before certain fairly obvious things occur to us. I've been blessed in the sense of being a pretty healthy guy. The only time I've ever been in the hospital is when I've done harm to myself, cutting myself with a chainsaw, or when I was a kid falling out of a tree or whatever it may be. But, you know, like anybody else, every so often I'll get the flu or a stomach bug or something like that. And when I recover, I say, I hope I will remember what a blessing it is to feel good, and that I'll appreciate all the things that I have. And then too often I forget it. Similarly, I'll lose somebody that's really, really close to me, and I'll think to myself, well, I spend a fair amount, but I got to spend more time in touch with my friends, because life is so fragile. That's easy to forget as well. I miss and mourn John a lot. He was a great friend of mine. I think vilely undernoticed. He's a wonderful, wonderful
poet. As a poet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did he pass away?
He died a year ago this past June. I was in Alaska visiting my son. Oh, my whole family was in Alaska visiting my second son, our second son, who lives there. And I was in a bookstore, and my daughter-in-law, who lives in Burlington, who, along with her husband, my son, knew and liked and admired John, called me up to tell me he had unexpectedly had a massive heart attack during back surgery, and that he was very unlikely to revive. And as it turned out, he didn't. So it's been a year ago, June. Mm.
So his poetry, what would you say were the?
Well, the thing that I really I found enviable in John's poetry was what I would call an incredibly muscular syntax. He could write a sentence that was practically Jamesian in length. But he had such control over the syntax that you never thought, oh, where the heck am I now? I out of curiosity, once I took, and I can't remember, I think it was this book called Cardinals in the Ice Age, I took a poem or two and actually wrote out, just for curiosity, wrote out a few of the sentences, and they went on forever, you know. I mean, they really did. I had just a big legal pad, and they'd go down three or four lines, margin to margin, but that heavy subordination and that, what I'm calling that muscular syntax, was always in such control that you didn't notice that kind of thing, and it enabled him to cover a lot of emotional and intellectual ground in a non-flamboyant way, in an unself-vaunting way. I think that was the thing that. I hope there's some of that in my own writing, and if there is, that's where it comes from. I met him very early on in my writing career. It was 1976. I was a scholar at the Red Loaf Writers Conference, and he was a fellow. He was, like me, a bit of a late bloomer, and he was the sort of sidekick for Mark Strand in a class. And I found myself much more, not that I had animosity to Strand, but I found John's take on poetry much more sympathetic. And we became friends, and I became an admirer of what was then, I suppose, the two-book bibliography that John had. And I studied them, I reviewed them. I discovered that quality. I think it has to do with some people say, well, you write in several genres. How do you do that? And so on. And I don't have any good answer to that. I'm agnostic on the issue. But I think maybe that interest in sentence structure within poetry has to do with the almost equal attraction I have to lyric and to story. Mm-hmm. I write fewer and fewer explicitly narrative poems, but the implications of narrative, I think, are in my work. There's a story that can be inferred, even if it's not said aloud. And I suppose that interest in that kind of syntax is in some way or another connected with that dual pull.
You've called Robert Frost your hero. What about Robert Frost and his work most appeals to you?
You know, I have nothing original or bright to say about that. It's the same thing that his fans are always attracted by, and that's what he called the sound of sense. Here was an author who, like me, although I think I'm a little more inobvious in doing this for the most part. Here's an author who did not jump on the free verse bandwagon, always wrote metrically, often in a rhyming style, and yet the sense of actual spoken language, what his predecessor Wordsworth had in the sexist language of his own time, said that real language used by real men. It just seems so patent in Frost. So I hear, and I don't have an axe to grind, mind you, in this free verse, formal verse. I'm not a partisan. I just do what I do. It's not out of ideological conviction. But when I do hear the free verse propagandists say, well, we have to write free verse in order to sound as if it were a real human speech, a preoccupation, by the way, which exists only in America. It's not a concern, say, in Eastern European poetry or Latin American poetry. But when they say we have to write in free verse in order to sound like the human voice, I say, well, you know, I'll tell you what, you read a passage of Ezra Pound, and I'll read a passage of Robert Frost, and you tell me, in all honesty, which one sounds more like a person actually talking. I also like the fact that, I mean, Frost, in a sense, he was, like all of us, a terribly flawed human being. Not nearly as flawed as some of his biographers have indicated. Biographers who overlook the immense pain that he went through in a very short period of time with deaths in his family and madness in his family and what have you. But he contributed to the notion that he was a twinkly little New England Cracker Barrel philosopher. I mean, if it was going to make him popular, he'd go along with it. There's no doubt that he had that kind of egotistical drive. But he is, in my opinion, the most complex of the modernist poets. You read almost any of his, even his shorter lyrics, and he throws the conclusions of that poem almost completely upon you. You know, there's that famous sonnet called Design, where he sees a spider feasting on a moth that has landed on a heal-all plant, which had been turned white by the weavings of the spider. And at the end he says, what caused all this to happen? And he says, what but design of darkness to appall? And then he says, if design govern in a thing so small. And you're left to think, well, that's a kind of a grim poem, but what's the grim part of it? Is it that there's design in the universe that is dark? Or is it that there's no design at all? Do you prefer a dark design to none at all? Do you prefer absolute sort of cosmic anarchy to at least a coherent package? He won't tell you. You've got to think about it yourself. And I love his capacity to take what seem like the most commonplace occurrence, you know, from the death of the hired man to looking at a wood pile abandoned in the woods, and to make extremely challenging material out of it, all the while sounding absolutely accessible.
Yeah.
I like that everybody can get something out of a Frost poem. Mm-hmm. You know, you can take that poetry to the Union Hall, you can take it to the first grade, you can take it to graduate students, you can take it to specialists. And everybody can get something. That's something that you can't say, for example, Wallace Stevens or T.S. Eliot, you know, greatest both those writers are.
How much of what you write would you guess actually ends up being used in a finished piece of work?
A fairly high percentage, and I'll tell you why. I only work on one thing at a time.
Okay.
In other words, like any generality, there's some aberrations from it, but I don't have a whole bunch of poems going at once. I'm working on one at a time. And I have a few confidants with whom I share it, share the work. And if after 20 drafts or whatever, I'm still not making it, then I'll put it aside. I'm stubborn, as I think maybe you have to be in being a writer. But I hope I'm not perverse, and if I haven't gotten it within 20 drafts, I'll put it aside. I'll probably come back to it. In this book, there's a
To the Bone?
Yeah, a poem called The Fourth of July, which I went back to after having set it aside for 15 years, you know. Really set it aside. I did not, and then something happened in my life, nothing particularly dramatic, and all of a sudden I said, that's what I needed right along for that poem. So it's not like I was working on it for 15 years, but it was, that's an extreme case. But I tend to, when I say there's a fairly high percentage that is ultimately used, that I'm not commenting on its quality. I'm just saying that because I'm kind of like a bulldog and I won't let go of something until it's just been proven to me that it's inedible. I just keep worrying it with my jaws until it becomes what it wants to be. I use most of what I've written. I don't write in two genres at a time. I'm either writing poetry or I'm writing prose. And there's nothing prescriptive about that. That's just the way I am. I know plenty of people who have, you know, some people are reading several books at once. I can't do that. Some people are writing several things or in several genres at once. I can't do that. Or I've told myself I can't do that. You get to a certain point in life and you have your own little private superstitions. Well, if I do this, then I won't be able to write. So as long as I'm not experiencing any block, I just keep on doing what I've done for a while now.
How do you know when a collection is complete?
I remember a person who was very good to me when I was starting out in my 30s as a writer. I was lucky enough to know Robert Penn Warren, and he described it as having a sense that a certain arc of energy had been completed, that the stuff that you were writing now was coming from somewhere else in your life, from some other fascination. You might not even know what it was, but you could feel intuitively that it was not part and parcel of what you had been writing for a certain length of time. I took that to heart, and I always said, well, I know when I've got a collection. Now, my ninth collection, which I sent to my publisher a year ago, was by her lights. not a book, which, of course, made me grumpy and condescending.
Because there wasn't enough there?
Or? No. She just didn't think it was a real... the way she put it was, it doesn't explain itself in terms of having had to be written. There was some sort of urgency in it that was lacking. And I think I'd fallen into the notion that, you know, I had X number of pages, more than I could use, and every single one of the poems had been reasonably handsomely published, and therefore it was a book. Well, after fuming about this, as one would do if he or she has any ego at all, I guess we all do, and not writing, you know, going out and playing and doing other things or writing other sorts of things, I went back and I looked at it and I said, well, you know, she's absolutely right. There's plenty of pages, and the individual poems are, by my standards, good. But it's not a book. It's not, you know, what the French call a well-made book. It doesn't have any particular trajectory. It's a bunch of good poems slapped together. So I'm going to try again with her this January, I think. But maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm going to wait even longer than that. I think I submitted that book of poems prematurely because I had just gone on Social Security, and to me that had a certain resonance. I said, well, you know, I'm running out of time, you know. And then not too long after that, this is totally counterintuitive, but my little granddaughter Cora, who lives in Burlington, was born. And the effect that it had on me was I got more time than I thought. I mean, that doesn't make any sense, I suppose, but psychologically that was definitely the effect. And I didn't feel... I mean, any of us could walk out and get hit by a truck tomorrow. I just had a physical, and I'm apparently in very good health. But something could happen tomorrow. I don't know whether or not, none of us knows whether or not such a thing will transpire. But for the moment, I'm just going to assume that if I just keep putting one foot in front of the other, I have time to do the book the way it ought to be done. I have to confess one thing, though. Robert Penn Warren is very clearly an exception to this, but I have known poets of a certain age, you know, Social Security age and up, as I am now, who really sort of lose it and become self-imitative and believe that what they write is excellent and wonderful and to be shared with the world, when in fact it's not. And I hope there's somebody around to tell me, hey, you know, you've written all the poems that are in you. You know, now go enjoy your granddaughter in the woods as long as you're still able. I hope that hasn't happened to me yet, but I may be the last one to know. Certainly the older poets I'm thinking of, they didn't know, and nobody was going to tell them.
Well, one would think that starting at 40 means you've got more time than they do.
Well, maybe. I don't know. And you know, when I was trying to get my first book published, I was kind of lucky in the sense that it happened more quickly than certainly it would today with so much competition. I went around collecting the names of people like Robert Frost and Muriel Rukeyser and Wallace Stevens and someone who didn't publish books until they were 40. Now I'm going around looking at people whom I admire who were writing really well when they were older. I mean, Maxine Human, to me, is writing at the height of her powers now in her 80s. I love her work. I liked the late work of Red Warren as much as anything that he wrote in his career. So I'll keep my eye out for those good old poets.
Yeah, this would be fiction, and I'm trying to remember what she was doing toward the end. But Grace Paley was writing. Grace,
oh yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. She right to the last minute. Absolutely.
Yeah. Salman Rushdie edited the latest Best American Short Stories, mm-hmm. And I was reading this the other day, and I wanted to ask you about something he says, because you were an editor of the New England Review, mm-hmm. for 13 years after founding it. And he said that in this year's submissions, what he found, I'm just going to say the quote, old-fashioned naturalism was the dominant manner this year, and creative writing ease, I have to say, was often in evidence. There were so many stories that were well-observed, well-crafted, full of well-honed phrases, so many rhythmic, elusive, technically sophisticated stories that knew when to leave matters unresolved and when it was right to bring events to a dramatic climax. So many stories that had everything one could wish for in a story, except for the sense that it had to be written, that it was necessary. This was what I had expected and perhaps feared, a widespread, humorless, bloodless competence. And then he goes on to say that he also had wonderful, wonderful mm-hmm. stories to mm-hmm. select from. And I'm just wondering if that was a sense that you ever felt when you were an editor.
Sure, but I'm sure the editors of the Dial did too, and I'm sure that Harriet Monroe did at Poetry. If you go back and look at the writing of any given time, 99% of it is competent, controlled, and not very interesting. Hmm. I don't think there's anything novel about that. Smart people like Don Hall go around blaming creative writing programs for this. Creative writing programs are much too young for us to make a judgment on them yet. You know, I mean, Iowa was the first one, and it's not even 80 years old. That's an eye blink in human history and even in literary history. I was this year a panelist for the NEA Poetry Fellowships. I read an awful lot of poetry. I really did. I read about 4,000 pages of poetry, and we had to whittle it down to 42 fellowships. And most of it was smooth. One was obliged to have published one book before applying anyway, so there was a level of competence and ease with language that was in evidence. Of the 42 that were selected, I would say, from my perspective, there were 10 that I found genuinely exciting. But I don't think that that's a brand new phenomenon. I don't think that's the result of creative writing ease at all. We haven't all of a sudden become a bunch of slick writers. The slick writers were always there. There may be more of us now because of creative writing, but time will anthologize. You know, we don't have to worry about the fact that there are lots of not terribly interesting or urgent writers who are nonetheless competent with language. That's not something we have to worry about. And Salman Rushdie, obviously, is a brilliant man, but neither he nor any of us knows if we're any good in our own lifetime. Who can say? I remember reading a review of Wallace Stevens' Harmonium, his first book, which is a kind of a definitive landmark in American poetry, and the reviewer said, there is some obscurity here, but if it is purged, Mr. Stevens may vie with the likes of Trumbull Stickney. Now, I mean, I know who Trumbull Stickney is just because I'm a weirdo, but nobody else knows who he is. But he's one of the most popular and well-regarded poets of his time in the early part of the last century. So if it were a matter of contemporaries' judgment, we'd have absolutely everything to say about James Fenimore Cooper and zero to say about Herman Melville. You know, so I don't worry too much about those about those issues. I know they make people passionate on both sides, but like most passionate debates, they end up really making both sides sound a little stupid.
What have you read lately that you've enjoyed?
Well, I'm right in the middle of late to read it, but the Jeffrey Eugenides fascinating novel called Middlesex that won the Pulitzer Prize a couple years ago, I suppose. I've been rereading my friend Mark Jarman's collection of poetry called The Green Man. I think that's one of the really wonderful things that has come out recently. Read the Marilynne Robinson's sequel to Gilead called Home. Every word that woman writes fills me with admiration, which is a nobler form of envy, I suppose. I think she must be one of the most brilliant people in America. I recently see, I reread Every Man by Philip Roth, which is a chastening book to read if you're a man of a certain age. I don't know, my reading is completely unsystematic. Whatever catches my eye when I'm in a bookstore, I'm a bookstore type. I don't tend to order things online at all. I just wander around and something catches my attention, I buy it. I recently read it was the first Claire Massoud I'd ever read, called The Emperor's Children. She's a marvelous writer. They're curiously, almost Victorian in a structure, all these plots and subplots. Nice big fat book. I like big fat books. My only quibble with it was that there wasn't anybody in it that I liked. I found almost all of the characters totally, totally contemptible, but it was a real tour de force of writing.
Was that the intention for all the characters to be?
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's one whom I kind of like. You know, she has her flaws, but most of them, are meant to be presented as pretty unattractive exemplars of 21st century hustle. Yeah. You know, the kind of thing that's lately gotten us in trouble economically.
I listened to a tape of a great lecture that you gave when you were at Vermont College about submitting to journals.
Oh, yeah.
One of your suggestions, a piece of advice that I now always follow, is that a writer should avoid sending work at the beginning or at the end of a reading period, because editors will be drowning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you want to just mention a few other pieces of advice.
I think the farther my experience as an editor recedes into the past, probably the less relevant my commentary on my contemporary publishing is. I'm in the same boat as you are. I just send work out and wait for a response. But the whole, the supervention of the internet, of online publishing, online magazines and so on, I think that's really changed the equation. The profusion of MFA programs has meant that there are an awful lot of problems. I mean, in the last year that I edited The England Review, which was 1989, we were getting about 300 poems a week. And I assume that it's gone up since. So it's a real crapshoot, you know? I mean, it's a real crapshoot. Even if you're good, just the math works against you. But one of the things that I may have said in that lecture, which was given, as I recall, rather more closely in time to my editorial tenure, was I discourage double submissions. Mm-hmm. Well, they're absolutely par for the course nowadays. I still tend not to do it myself. If I don't hear within 3 months or so, then I'll send my work elsewhere. But and if I do double submit, I make it clear to both parties that I am double submitting. I tend to think that the traditional lit mags like Hudson Review or Georgia Review or Gettysburg Review, Southern Review, I tend to think that probably that's still good advice about not sending in September or June. September, everybody has been waiting for the floodgates to open, and in June your editor wants to take his or her vacation. He or she won't get much of it anyway, you know, because I remember we closed up shop on June the 1st, and I was still reading up to, you know, at least till the 1st of August.
Wow.
So, there's a kind of, the resentment of your editor is not something that you would advisedly invite. I mean, the one thing that I think will hold true forever, even if we start having artificial intelligence as editors, is that you don't want to overburden someone. You know, I'm not going to send 12 poems to someone, and I'm not going to send 100 pages of prose or even 40 pages of prose without a prior query. I mean, we did do some stories that were probably 40 pages in length, but we had we had cleared the deck for that that possibility ahead of time. People who have not been involved on that side of the desk in publication don't realize what the volume is and how incredibly relentless it is. And I would, you know, I clear a shelf in the New England Review office at Middlebury and take it home for the weekend and feel great, and then get down to the campus mail and fill it up that very day. You know, I take it home on Friday, work all weekend, go down to the post office on Monday and fill it up. That gap in the shelf only lasted, you know, for as long as the post office was closed. I'm glad to have, one of the things I'm glad to have been on that side of the desk for is that I don't take rejection personally. I know what it is. I know what the odds are. I mean, most of my stuff eventually finds its way into print, but if I'm turned down, I say, oh my God, my life was over, I'll never publish again, anything of that nature. You have to learn to live with the rejection, it seems to me, especially if you're doing something non-commercial. Like poetry, you have to realize that rejection is the norm, not otherwise. And then there are other things that can happen that are completely beyond your control. I mean, when Howard Moss was editor of the New Yorker, you know, I could count on 3 or 4 appearances a year. And then there was a change in venue, and I published 2 poems in the New Yorker probably in a dozen years, so the rate went down, and now Paul Muldoon is the editor, and I haven't cracked the ice there yet. So I mean, you know, there can be a turnover in personnel, and the guy that really liked what you were doing before may be replaced by the gal who doesn't have any time for you, a bit of time for you. So
how do you define success for yourself in your work?
Well, you know, early on, like every beginning writer, you know, I had a barrel full of, quote, encouraging rejections, to use that oxymoron. And it's discouraging, there's no doubt about it. And I just remember, I even remember where it was. It was on the top of a particular mountain in New Hampshire. I said to myself, look, is this something you're doing because you can't find a substitute for it? Or is it something you're doing to get famous at? And I thought, I'm doing it because it's something that that helps me to make sense of my life. And I'll just keep doing it and let the chips fall where they may. And it was at that point when I stopped trying to second-guess editors. When Howard was the editor of the New Yorker, I said, boy, it'd be great to get a poem in the New Yorker. Now, let me see. The last few poems have, you know, they've had glass in them, and they've mentioned the sea, and they've had one foreign word. So when I would try and write these poems to incorporate what I thought, and of course they were terrible poems because they were written up to what I assumed somebody else's expectations were. And the minute I made that resolution that I was going to do it because it's what I did, not because it was a means to some other end, then I started to get published. You know, the statistics on the number of people who took MFAs who are still writing after about 5 years are kind of alarming. You know, they're very, very, it's a very, very small number. In my experience, I've had several students who've had very respectable careers as writers. They were not necessarily the most talented students I had, but they were the most persistent. They were the ones who couldn't find a substitute for writing, you know. My son, who is in Burlington, I don't think he'll object to my saying this. You know, he went to the Iowa Writers Workshop and wrote brilliant stories, and he was in that 25 under 25 Norton anthology and so on. But he's also a musician and played in a number of bands and extremely crafty with his hands. And now he makes custom guitars, custom electric guitars, which are works of art, and are played by such bands as the Pretenders, just for example.
Wow.
And are, by the way, here's a plug, you can look up Creston, C-R-E-S-T-O-N, Electric, Google it, and you'll see a gallery of the work. And I think that, you know, I every so often he sort of chastises himself for not writing. But he has found a creative substitute, which is more than eminently respectable, but also fulfills that creative impulse in him. So maybe he's not writing now. He's not very old. He can go back to writing. He has all the tools of being a very, very good writer, and for now, that's not his primary preoccupation. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the determinative thing, you know. I've just got to do this because I can't figure out what else I'd be doing if I didn't. You know, I mean, I have an inclination to the verbal which is almost catastrophic. You know, I love to run my mouth and words and language. It's sort of my world is deeply dependent on them, and it's been an interesting life. You know. I'm glad that when I came to writing, I decided to start off as a poet as an editor, because it became crystal clear to me early on that to be a famous poet meant that you would perhaps draw as many fans as an exhibition game of the Colorado Rockies at spring training. It's not realistic to say you're going to be a famous poet. You might be famous within a certain. That's never meant a hell of a lot to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not just being modest. I've got enough of a reputation, but reputation is not for me what it's all about. You know?
Right. My last question is always the same. For writers who might be listening, do you have any advice for what they might do when they're stuck in their work?
I do think this, that no one has ever written well by not writing. If you're a poet and the poetry is not coming, write something. Write a journal. If the journal doesn't work out, write a letter. I know that's an archaic thing to do, but you can do it via email. This racket, like any other, demands sits time. It's funny, so much of the world has this curiously adolescent view of artists, including poets and novelists, that somehow they walked outside one day and the lightning struck and they became William Blake. We wouldn't think that even of someone like Michael Jordan with his prodigious talent, you know, that all of a sudden he was maybe the best basketball player that ever lived. You asked him, and he was in the gym every afternoon practicing his moves, you know. He had, to be sure, prodigious native talent, but so did a lot of his contemporaries, no doubt. He became what he was because he was dogged and determined to get better all the time. Don't sit around waiting for the lightning to strike. The lightning may strike, but it'll only strike if you are in the act of writing. I don't write every day now, but I certainly did when I first started out. I mean, I was a tiger. I said, I arranged my teaching schedule at Dartmouth so that I was teaching only in the afternoon. I got up very early in the morning. My kids weren't old enough yet that they needed to be ferried to school or whatever. I got up before anybody else did, and I was determined that I was going to write at least 3 hours a day. I'd write from 5 to 8 every day, including weekends. And I'm glad to have done that, because anything you do a lot of, you're going to get better at. Mm-hmm. You may not get great, but you're certainly going to get better. Sitting there trying to strategize, however, is not going to get you anywhere.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you.
And let's go vote.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Sidney Lee. Next week, tune in again at 9 a.m. to hear a full recording of the memorial event celebrating the work and life of Vermont poet Hayden Carruth. The celebration took place in Montpelier earlier this month. Hayden Carruth died on September 29th of this year at the age of 87. Today's Write the Book prompt concerns setting. How can a writer describe setting in such a way that it informs readers about a character's or narrator's state of mind? Consider the following two excerpts from works by today's guest, Sidney Lee. This is from his essay, Alone with Friends, A Journal Towards Springtime. Landy and I sat for a spell on the tailgate, staring at the clean dark that walked at a human pace up the mountains, feeling a flake or two of snow on our wrists and faces, noting a heron who came languidly, flapping out of a back pond, roost-bound early. And this is from Sidney Lee's poem, The Author, in March. Remnant rank corn snow perspires like dirty dough. What few drab birds there are don't fly up very far. So hard do the clouds bear down, not much to this splotch of a town. Flue smoke, small talk, clutter, last autumn's leaves clog gutters. So here's this week's prompt. Imagine a place in a poem or story that you're thinking about writing or already writing. Using minimal description, make a list of several things, five or six details that exist in that setting. Now rewrite the list, describing those same details as seen from the perspective of a character who is upset, frustrated, or depressed. Then write the list one last time, describing these same things from the point of view of a character who is happy, optimistic, or excited. Don't change the actual details of place, but the lens through which they are viewed. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Hike Bedrosian is up next. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.